Welcome to another episode of Software Gone Wild, a podcast focused on all things software-defined that have something to do with networking. Today, we'll delve into a new area, into software-defined VPNs. But before we go there, let me introduce my co-host for today, David G. from the sunny UK. David, how are you doing today?
I'm pretty good, thank you. Not so sunny, though. I don't know where you're getting your weather report from.
Oh, I'm looking at old websites. What did you think?
Typical internet stuff. A little bit out of date, but there you go. Yeah, we've got almost sideways rain at the moment. Really bad wind, and my house pretty much got trashed last week. So, yes, all great fun.
Oh, my. Don't go there. Okay, instead of discussing weather, let's focus on our guest. Today, we have a very, very distinguished engineer, and Khalid, I think we go back for like 20 years, right?
Yes, 1997.
Yeah, so we met in a weird meeting in Germany discussing BGP problems with some service provider that shall remain nameless. I already revealed his first name. With us today is Khalid Raza, now working for an interesting startup called Viptela. Before we go into Viptela, Khalid, do tell us, or, well, the three people that don't know your history, what were you doing and how you came to Viptela?
Yeah, so before I go a little bit on my history, I'd like to tell David. David, it's sunny in California.
Oh, thank you for that.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly what we needed. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
So a little bit about my history. I started at Cisco in 1993. My background is I've worked with most tier one service providers in US, and as Ivan mentioned, we met at a weird meeting at a very major service provider in Europe as well. And also, I was very actively working with Cisco's Fortune 100 companies, from financials to retail, putting their networks together, putting their architectures together. So I'm a big fan of major routing protocols, worked extensively. And in certain cases, if you find my bigotry towards layer three, it's just part of the package because that's what I lived my life with.
Totally understood. I mean, if we have perfectly good solutions, why would we throw them away?
Exactly.
So what brought you to Viptela and what is Viptela?
Essentially, my partner and I, Amir, when I left Cisco, we started to do some consulting. And one of the things, one of the themes that was consistently we were noticing, we were consulting with a very large financial. The consistent theme was one of their senior executive, I was sitting in the meeting, asked his team, so I want to start this remote expert program. The idea is, if I'm in a financial industry, a person walks into a financial bank and in a retail branch, and there is nobody who can help him with the mortgage. They said, I can place these people strategically, and they can dial up anybody and get a remote expert. The answer was, can't do this. And the question was, why can't we do this? They don't have enough bandwidth in these sites. And I still remember distinctly that executive asking, I pay $75 a month. While I'm watching Netflix, my kids are playing video, and you're telling me I'm paying $300 a month and I don't have enough bandwidth? So essentially, the theme that started to emerge from that side was, can I get a hybrid connectivity? As you get into this hybrid connectivity, you get into a very, very interesting problems from the perspective of multiple type of connectivity models. And we started to study that one connectivity is internet-based, the other is MPLS-based. Each one of them have a different distinct connectivity models that you have to build. One kind of overlay VPN on the internet-based, different kind over MPLS. And why MPLS was so attractive from early days customer perspective, I had a single control plane and I got a ubiquitous data plane. As long as you're within my MPLS environment, I can connect you anywhere to anywhere. And we started to look at that, said, why can't we take this model and start creating technology that can provide similar functionalities of a ubiquitous connectivity anywhere to anywhere, regardless of transport type? We did a lot of studying in this space and said, because of the data model shifts, that the data consumption model in enterprises are shifting. They were pretty much four-walled. And that's the other thing that we heard from our customers saying, 70% of my data is now internet-bound. And it's very expensive for me to trombone those, that traffic from defined DMZ points. I would like to have a little bit more flexibility. And hence, if you notice the theme, now the security parameters are shifting. So looking at all these problems, we said there is some interesting innovation that needs to happen in the wide area space, which is, should be evolutionary with revolutionary results. You can't replace 30 years of innovation we've learned in our different industry. So what can we do to bring these concepts in the software-defined networking space with evolutionary path towards these revolutionary topologies which we're going to build? And from our opinion perspective, if you look at it, cloud is the largest VPN we are going to build. And we need to make these networks scale to the level we've scaled internet.
So effectively, you reinvented MPLS on overlay networks.
I would say we evolved MPLS concepts for overlay networks.
Okay. How far along are you in this process? Do you have a shipping product?
Actually, we are in production. We have two production customers at this point, and we have closed about 30 active trials going on at this point with major retailers, major financials, and also the two. One production is a major healthcare provider, and the other production is a major retailer.
Whereabouts are those customers based? Are they just in the US, or have you got any in Europe at the moment?
Interestingly, if you go to these high-end customers, the customer base is in U.S., but our initial production deployment is our data plane points are sitting in Europe and in Middle East, and our controller is sitting in the United States.
That's interesting.
These three locations where they're being serviced out of, so they have a data center site which sits in U.S., the controller resides in the U.S., one site which is a plane data plane point which is in U.K., and the other is in Dubai.
Okay, so you already mentioned some of the components of your architecture. Obviously, you have a controller which is doing something, and then you have the, let's say, VPN termination endpoints, sort of.
Right, sort of, yeah.
And you call them the data plane points.
Yes.
How does all this fit together?
If you look at this thing, one of the interesting observations you will hear from customers, I actually, with the retail customer we're talking to, they pointed out that their head-end router ran out of routing adjacency capacity. I asked him a question, so what's the data forwarding capacity of this box? He says about 10 gig. How many adjacencies they were holding? They were holding about 600 to 700 adjacencies and said, I need to upgrade this box because I don't have enough control plane capacity. If you look at it from the software-defined networking model point of view, why software-defined networking was so attractive is you wanted to move computationally intensive algorithms out of networking hardware. Now, in traditionally where we build networking, this computationally intensive control plane was in every hardware point, and BGP route reflector is a very interesting case in point that MPLS carriers started to move route reflector off path to do best path algorithms. Now, if you look at the traditional way where a lot of enterprise, where they build their network, they put these control plane points in path. And that's where they make their routing decision, they select a best path. The customer pointed out that they are out of capacity in their number of adjacencies they can hold. They're not out of capacity on the forwarding plane of their box. If you look at it, we're moving that higher computational capacity that is available on all off-the-shelf servers. So they're taking it out, not embedding it in the network, and you're putting it off path. From that perspective, now we can scale this model out. So that goes out. Now the device that sits in there can understand that, discover the local site characteristics. If there is a local IGP running or a local routing running where I'm showing up in a newer site, I can learn that and report it to the controller that this is what I've discovered on my site. We run traditional routing protocols like OSPF and BGP. We discover it and tell the controller that this is my site discovery. Then the controller said, I will give you your policies, how you would connect out of your site. So from the external point of view, or to build these overlay, your policy and configuration of external connectivity is at the controller, and controller decides your policy. Controller pushes your data plane connectivity model while you discover your local site. So one of the point of view we came is a lot of people are equating SDN to configuration automation. We looked at it slightly differently than others. We said configuration automation is a smaller path. Reducing the extensive number of control planes to form different control plane forming different type of relationship, and each of that control plane that it requires its own policy and configuration. If we can collapse these large number of control plane into a single control channel, then the number of configuration that is needed for wide area would be significantly reduced. the configuration element that you need to do for a site basis is only site-level configs, at what VLANs this interface belongs to, what routing protocol and the site discovery I want to run into. So from our point of view, if you look at what Vitella Send does, it gives you a secure, authenticated, fully encrypted path with very, very minimalistic config, because those are the extensions we're making to some of the existing protocols, which we want to publish by end of next year, saying that this is how you can really, really simplify this extensively configured environments and reducing the number of control planes.
Interesting. You mentioned quite a lot of stuff there. One of the things that I pick up on, and what I think one of the questions I want to pose is, let's say we take a cheaper form of connectivity, like, you know, in Europe especially, we take something like ADSL2, and then we kind of get one of these endpoints, one of these data endpoints. So then we have a situation where can this work, first of all, with, say, dynamic IP addressing on a lower cost provider? So does the endpoint talk to the controller, or is there some kind of DNS mechanism for all of the endpoints? And I realize I'm going into some of the technical stuff here. There's a scenario I just want to kind of bottom out in my head, and hopefully it will make sense for anybody listening.
Yeah, so no, absolutely. That's a very interesting question. So one of the observations we made here is, as we started to build these VPNs, we were nailing down a lot of our connectivity model on IP prefixes or IP addresses. And when we build these overlay subnet or we ran overlay routing protocols, we nailed them down on overlay subnets that we were creating to form routing adjacencies. One of the things we've bent and said, there has to be a better mechanism. If we can authenticate this device where the IP dependency goes away, there are certificates, there are PKI models, and I won't go into the details of how we're doing that authentication at this point, but at some point when we come out of complete information into public space, we will be explaining how we're doing it. But essentially, when I bring the device up and I authenticate that device through certificates or PKI, then whatever IP addresses you're coming from, that's not relevant to me. And one of the things we do is the only globally addressable point that our whole system requires is an orchestrator, where you put an entry in your DNS or give a static IP address of that orchestrator on the edge device, that when an edge device comes up, and today Vitella is working on zero-touch provisioning model on the same concept, when an edge device comes up, it contacts that orchestration point, says, you're the only globally routable IP address I have. And it contacts it. At that point, we authenticate that device through certificate exchange. Now I don't care what IP address you're coming from. Once okay. You have that authentication done, similarly, the controller is also authenticated with that orchestrator. Now we can punch hole between those two points. Even both of them can be sitting through NAT through stun mechanisms. And now you can connect. So to us, IP endpoints are not relevant. Only single IP identity is given to the box. It doesn't have to be a public address. It's just an identifier of the box.
Thank you. That's nice and clear. You also mentioned more bandwidth. So I'm just assuming here, can you handle multiple links from different providers? So, you know, link bundling almost. So I know there's some cheaper DSL providers out there that will take a number of low-cost DSL lines, bundle them all up with some device on the end that pretends to aggregate them into a bigger channel. So is that something that you can do as well?
We are more on the layer 3 side. So from our perspective, it's looking like an IP circuit. You can connect to a single provider. You can connect to multiple providers. From us, it's a layer 3 connectivity, and we can route across it through ECMP. We can actually do weighted ECMP.
Okay.
That one link has a higher bandwidth, the other link has a lower bandwidth, and we can weight based on that and split traffic across those two points.
Perfect. So from that then, a single site, you know, even if it's using multiple links, will still appear to be, let's say, on a higher aggregate interface logically, even though obviously underlying it's formed of different circuits or from different providers?
So if you're coming in from different providers, and one of the things we do in our architecture, you can literally identify what type of circuit you're connecting to, and based on that type of circuit characteristics, you can centrally make policy. One of the things is you can say, this circuit is MPLS, this circuit is connected to, say, carrier one broadband. And based on that, you can centrally say policy, all my voice traffic, because of SLA, will always go through MPLS circuit. While all my bulk data, or if it's going to YouTube, or if it's going to any application that is servicing, or if it's bulk data transfer, it can take the broadband circuit. So in a system, we have given link attributes, and those link attributes are advertised. And at that point, you can centrally make the decision how you want to even route your traffic based on the application profiles.
That's interesting.
Okay, so to tap back a little bit. You need data path point on site. Is that your device, or are you reusing the functionality of, let's say, existing Cisco routers?
One of the things that we do is when we talk about data plane, the data plane, we have two flavors. One is the hardware, which is pure commodity-based. Today, which is a Cavium-based because of predictable encryption performance. Mm-hmm. The other we're using is a software, which could be on an x86-based. We are doing more work on the x86 side now as well because x86 today doesn't give you that much predictable encryption performance. Hardware for us is off-the-shelf commodity hardware, which gives you encryption and predictable performance.
So you would get multiple uplinks from multiple providers. It may be a DSL modem, it may be a PE handoff, it may be a CE handoff, whatever it is. Yes. You connect your data plane module to all these different uplinks and to the internal side of the network, and then you do your magic.
Yes. Yes.
And your magic, if I understood correctly, on the internal side is discovering the routing protocols and you start participating in them to learn the prefixes?
Yes. Or if there is a direct layer 2 connectivity, whatever VLAN you've configured, we completely support VRRP as well. So all those standard functionalities we support.
So you can be the default gateway or you can be a router talking to another router.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then on the WAN side, you register through all the uplink IP addresses to the orchestrator.
Right.
Then you build the encrypted tunnels between these data plane endpoints based on what the orchestrator is telling you, and that's it.
Yeah, so interestingly, one of the things that I want to point out is this encrypted tunnel concept. The encrypted tunnel is whenever you're building an encrypted tunnel over an untrusted third party. Trusted third party, you can always say that GDOI doesn't require you to build those encrypted control channels once you build a single control channel with the key server. In our model, we build the only control channel with the controller, then the data plane between these sites is AES-256 encrypted any-to-any connectivity model. So we're not building any control plane between those two data plane points. Their control plane is only with the controller, yet they build any kind of mesh or any kind of topology encrypted connectivity with each other. So IPsec encapsulation to us is no different than an Ethernet encapsulation the way we've implemented in our solution.
Just a technical detail, are you using group key or are you using peer-to-peer keys between the endpoints?
No group keys. It's peer-to-peer keys between those two endpoints.
Yeah, and you have the encrypted channel to the controller, so the controller is distributing the keys to the endpoints.
Right.
My favorite question, what happens if the controller fails?
Well, this is where the extensive years of working with large routed environments come in. We've done nonstop forwarding and nonstop routing in BGP and IGPs. What happens is, if I lose connection to all my controllers, then there is a time limit that we inform that this site, where the controller informs all the site that if you still have a data plane connectivity to this guy, you can continue to forward traffic between those two points, and this entry is stale. So while the device that has lost connectivity tries to connect back to the controller, and if it fails, remember, this device also is a router. So if you have a single connection out of that site and this is the only way to connect, then you're out of luck anyway because you don't have any backup connectivity model. Now, if you have just lost connection to the controller while your data plane is still functioning, you continue to forward your data plane packet as long as your encryption keys are valid. And at that point, both of you know that this entry is stale because you've lost connectivity to your controller. If you have a backup path, this device is also a layer 3 router. When I lose my connectivity on the overlay, I start to go back into the traditional routing protocol and I start routing through those and I stop being a default gateway and I stop advertising the default route.
So does that mean then that your product is, it really is an overlay solution into an existing solution? So let's say if we take a greenfield type deployment, somebody buys a load of circuits and they buy some of your data endpoints and the orchestration system. Under that scenario, then, if the controller goes down, are we saying that all the sites go down with it?
No, I'm saying if the controller goes down, as long as those sites have data plane connectivity, they'll continue to forward traffic. And based on their data plane, previously programmed data plane connectivity that they had established.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, I get that. So let's, whilst we're on this subject then, can we have some fallback configurations? So let's say we're on a site and it's internet facing. Great, you know, the WAN connection is internet facing. Could we say if the controller fails, place some NAT as like a, you know, as a last resort set of configurations, so at least there's internet connectivity for the sites?
You have internet connectivity as the site you start using the local default route. And if there are NATing functionality, you'll do the local NAT exit as well.
Okay.
Do you have to place your device in the forwarding path?
The controller?
No, the data plane device.
Yeah, if you want to build this encrypted overlay path, yeah, you will have to place us in path.
So what happens if the data plane device fails?
In this case, if there is a redundancy, right? So if redundancy, if the data plane device fails, so the data plane device failures could be multiple, right? If I lose connectivity to my controller, I immediately withdraw myself as the default gateway if it's a layer 2 environment and say I'm not the default gateway because I've lost my controller. If I lose connectivity, because remember, since this is a data plane control plane separation, if I've lost the controller, I don't want to be default gateway or I don't want to originate a default route. If I've also kept my connection to the controller and I've lost connectivity to the data plane router, which was giving me a default route, we immediately withdraw ourselves as the candidate that should be the primary path and say that whatever there is alternate path available, I'll start to take that alternate path available in the network.
So if you're running OSPF on site, for example,
right,
when you get the connectivity to the controller, you would start advertising the default route into the OSPF area.
Actually, there's a little bit more explanation required. So controller is just giving me all the data plane endpoints. Now, what happens is I might have a connectivity to the controller, but I might lose my connectivity to the data plane default router through which I'm going to go to those exit points. So, A, if I've lost connectivity to the controller, I better withdraw the default route because my entries are stale. B, if I've lost connectivity to the router, data plane connectivity to the router, which is in path that's taking me to the internet exit point or anywhere, if I lose connectivity to that device as well, I should withdraw the default route from OSPF's perspective as well. So there are two intelligent points that has to be understood in the system since we've separated the data plane and the control plane. So we look at both and say, if something is gone, missing, then back off from being the primary default router.
Does that also affect VRRP? So let's say under normal circumstances, I want ownership of that address. And if that fails, then basically just kind of stand back and let someone else take over?
Yes. Okay. Exactly the same behavior for VRRP.
Great.
One of the things that is very significantly different between us and a couple of other people working in this space is we do not build overlay subnet-based routing adjacency. So you don't have to build one layer of, say, MGRE, then you don't have to build an overlay subnet to map a routing protocol informed routing adjacency. The second biggest differentiator between us or and anybody in this space is one of the things that is consistently we heard from our customers is my line of business today wants a different type of connectivity models. What I mean by that is today when I provide a service to my line of business, the topology that I lay out for them, their services have to follow this topology. So if I have a guest Wi-Fi in a branch, I do want to monitor these guest Wi-Fi guys where they're going. So I want some security points to understand what sites they're going. I want to do some URL filtering. The second is I have retail guys. This is an exact use case we heard from a financial bank in the United States. What they're doing is they all have YouTube channels at this point. They have a very high churn in their retail. They want to regionalize that internet exit. I want a secure overlay connectivity where I can put a sort of a mini DMZ for these guys, where I can do all the IPS, IDS firewalling for the retail site of the branch. But I also have investment bankers, and I also have some of these high-end branches. I have mortgage brokers. For these guys, I want them to use the corporate DMZ because this could be high net worth, high profile data. So now look at a branch. I have a branch where I have three separate segments, which could be three separate VPNs, you can call them. Each VPN has its own independent topology. So the networks of tomorrow, the topology should be service driven. The service should not be topology driven. And this is something that we've looked into seriously from how architecturally we need to do this, that each line of business should be able to dictate, this is how I want my line of business to connect. Today, the network guys and say, no, this is how I've laid out my topology, and you have to abide by that topology.
So effectively, you created something like VRFs for different lines of business,
right?
With different default routes for every VRF.
Exactly, with a single peering connection to the controller.
Yeah, and instead of, let's say, let's talk about DMVPN, in which case we have the head-end router, which is also a BGP route reflector, let's say, and everyone peers with the DMVPN head-end router. You sort of took that away and replaced it with your controller.
You can say that, yes.
So you sort of have like DMVPN type solution, only there is no traffic going through the hub router.
Yes, and there are a few very clear distinctions. One of the things that you will notice, and I know, Ivan, from your background, you're a hardcore BGP guy, where I find some of these concepts problematic is one of the biggest power of BGP was the outbound attribute change. What I mean by that is what I have in my local routing table, and I'm saying, I, as a hub router, I want to exit this or the hub site to actually exit via the corporate DMZ. But I want these 50 branches, they might be doing dev and test inside of Amazon VPC cloud. I want these 50 guys to go through a regional exit point. The biggest power of BGP was I can change the external attributes and saying for these 50 guys, your next hub is that point. Now, you bring that concept into DMVPN when NHRP is doing a little bit more decision making, then you have a problem that you can't change the outbound attributes. You cannot have a discovery protocol smarter than the routing protocol. This is where my beef is, being, as I earlier mentioned, I'm a layer 3 routing bigot. I think the routing protocol should be much more intelligent than layer 2 discovery protocol.
Well, let's put it this way. A layer 2 protocol playing with the actual packet forwarding below the level of the FIB is immoral.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, that's my problem with DMVPN as well.
NHRP should not be smarter than BGP.
Well, that's debatable, but what I hate is that NHRP is changing the packet forwarding behavior without me being able to see it in the routing table.
And me being able to influence outbound routing table changes. That I can say, BGP next hop manipulation is a very interesting point for you to do. It says, whatever I have in my routing table, I will change the set next hop, and I want you guys to go a different path. And this type of topology is going to become very dominant. What I mean by that, as I earlier mentioned, a lot of big customers we're talking to, they're trying to build regional DMZs because of a lot of data. A lot of these service points are moving into colos. And they will go and say, I'll peer at these colos with Salesforce is sitting there, Office 365 is sitting there, Amazon is sitting there, I can get service in the VPC. Now, only these five branches need to go there. So I can selectively, either I can point a default route, or in certain cases in dev and test, I can de-aggregate one of my prefixes and put it on a virtual test bed. I've just put it on a cloud service. So now my subnets are decoupled. But I only want these five branches to know about this. Now, if I create a discovery protocol to detect that, then every time I want to make a routing change, I have to establish a control channel with the new point that's where I'm influencing a routing change. And in my opinion, it's the number of control planes that you build to just do defined connectivity points causes complication of both configuration and policy. So those type of models, by reducing the number of control planes, because each control plane has its own policy, and aggregating a lot of those control plane type functionalities into single control channel, you will have the capacity to centrally provision and push policy in the data plane. Because policy, forwarding policy, is a data plane function, and then the control plane just learns the intelligence, and based on that control plane intelligence, now I can push my forwarding policies.
I'm kind of full of questions, and I'm bursting almost. So I think, just kind of recapping on this stuff then, what we're actually saying is you can provide VRS facing a network, and then coupled with some intelligence, like with a controller, we're also adding PBR then per VRF to obviously make the data plane do a specific job based on policy. I mean, is that a fair summary?
It could be PBR. It could be each segment can have a different control policy. What I mean by that is, another thing that we do in our architecture is, one of the things that the system advertises is the services. So what I mean by that is I can now advertise if I have a firewall IPS IDS through a control plane path. And the control plane can decide whether you can go directly to the between source and destination, or you have to trembone through the service point. So in this case, if I decided a policy that it's a pure control policy that everybody who's sitting in VPN 1, they can't go direct into the data center. They all have to go through a firewall, right? And with this type of behavior, you don't have to put these firewalls in physical path. Now you can put these in the virtual path, which the NFV guys are talking about. So what I would do is I said, you can't go directly to the destination. Your first hop is the firewall path, and then firewall will take you to the final destination. So I can service chain these paths in pure control plane functions. If I want to do it for the entire VPN, then it's just a control plane next hop manipulation. If I want to do it in the data plane, then I would have to do is this. For these applications, you go through firewall. For the others, you still follow your classic routing. So it could be PBR, which is you mentioned, which is a data plane function, in my opinion, that how do you forward the data path for specific number of sources or specific number of application or services. Or if you want to do it for entire VPN, then you just do a control plane function where you manipulate the next hop.
Okay. Putting a cost context around this then, so if we had a, you know, a pretend customer that has a low budget for a network, could you, on your data path devices, whether that's the hardware or whether the software deployments, deploy stateless or stateful firewalling? So if we've got a new low-cost branch site springing up somewhere that we need part of the kind of corporate connectivity, is that something you can do with your technology?
No, so we are not in business of firewall. What we're saying, you can orchestrate path through that. If you connect any of these elements to our devices, we can service chain it, because we are pure connectivity play at this point. We can, okay. You can, based on your policy, you can say there is a firewall sitting connected to VEdge number, our edge device number 5. And then everybody knows that this is connected at this site, and anybody who wants to get firewall service, you can just manipulate to go through that firewall service. But from our perspective, firewalls would be traditional Palo Alto's connected there, or anybody's virtual firewall connected. It just takes a path through that firewall and goes on its merry way via routing.
Okay, understood. So one question that sprung to mind earlier on, if I've got some resources in Microsoft's Azure Cloud or some in Amazon, via the controller, could I orchestrate something, so bring up an image or a software version of the DataPath endpoint in a cloud somewhere, have that register with a controller, and automatically join the network and do discoveries on the back end?
Yes, if there is a local routing provision, yes, absolutely. Or otherwise, if it's a peer layer 2, then you'll have to provision a VLANs that it's connected to. But today we haven't productized the software version. We're doing a lot of testing. We want to productize it by end of the year. But all our entire test beds are completely virtualized, running on software versions. We're planning to productize it by end of this year.
Right, interesting. So that leads me to believe then that there, your control then, does it have an API? So can I drive it with something else?
Yes, it does have Northbound APIs. Actually, one of the interesting things that I want to mention here is, well, interestingly, a lot of our earlier testing is done that there are big customers who are testing. They run our controller on an x86 in their own environment. For a lot of early POCs that are going on with customers where they're saying, oh, I'll have to coordinate with my server guys to spin up this controller, why don't you guys host a controller and I want to do this testing, but I just get a data plane box shipped and it works. So what we do today in a lot of our early POCs, we're hosting controllers for our customers. We're running it out of, one of our controller runs out of Amazon Cloud. We're also hosting it at a Telex facility, and we host a couple of controllers in our office facilities for complete redundancy. And people do their testing functionality, how the system works. This is a very simple scale-out model. So when they feel comfortable and they have their server guys provision the OVAs for us, them, they can simply spin another controller on their side, and while the controllers run in redundancy, and then after a point they said, oh, I have two or three controllers in my environment, we simply decommission that test POC controller we were running for them, and their network just seamlessly moves into the newer controllers without any disruption.
Thank you.
So let's say I'm interested in this product and I want to test drive it. What's the next step?
There are a few things that, I mean, if you want to learn, there is information on the WebTelus website. Also, we have, you will be surprised, and our customers will tell you, our CEO is obsessed with documentation. He says You do not go out with a product with startup-style documentation. You go out with product with complete documentation that a customer can pick up and learn from it. So for
I love him already.
So you'll be surprised. Our fifth person who joined after the engineering team was a documentation person. And everything we did was documented. So what we do is today, when we partner with customers under NDA, we open up our documentation to our customers and open up our detailed documentation to people. We're not opening up to general public yet, but if you have a contract or if you have an NDA and you're doing POC, in your case, we, as we're discussing this, we will open up our documentation for you and you can have a look at detailed documentation. You'll be surprised how a startup has that much detailed documentation, because we did documentation from pretty much day one.
That's good to hear. That is, that's really good. So can I be really cheeky and say, let's say we go in with a well-known vendor solution based on either GetVPN or some, you know, something like DeanVPN, and we, I don't want to say cost it against yours, but position it against yours. How would you kind of come out from a kind of competitor point of view? So I've got to just ask it, I mean, is this more kind of cost advantageous long term, or is it from like a day one kind of instant cost savings?
There are a few different ways. Cost wise, yes, we are very cost competitive. The second piece is, the current view is, you will not have to go through tons and tons of lines of configuration from your wide area perspective. We were of the opinion that configurations do not solve the problem efficiently, protocols do. So if you embed a lot of those functionalities in it, make protocol much more intelligent, then pretty much configuration automation, other than the local site config, is gone. In my opinion, config automation is not SDN. It's a piece of it. Making intelligent protocol to make removing computationally intensive things out of a networking path and making protocols much more intelligent than configuration will give you a much more powerful solution. From operational point of view, one of the things we've done is, the people who are trying our boxes, literally you need three lines of config and you start encrypting data. Literally three lines of config. We were at a customer site testing. The box just need a local identity. It's identification from site's perspective, and the orchestration, orchestrator's IP address, and you're done. Literally, you're done from configuration point of view. All the other configuration is, if your local link connect to an OSPF peer, then you have to say, this is the VRF you might be sitting in, this is the VRF VP config. But those are very simplistic configuration for which people have been writing tickle scripts for years. But absolutely, from the other aspect of it is, it's just simply, we were bringing our solution up at a customer site at a carrier location. Interestingly, they gave us a day to bring up those 10 site network we were building. The guy went out, configured it. It was up in 45 minutes because we do not have extensive configurations.
Yeah, all you need is connectivity to the controller, and then you do everything on the controller.
Yeah, and then from Box's perspective, it just needs an identity. That's about it.
Mm-hmm. And that outside IP address.
It can get that outside IP address through DHCP.
Of course, yeah.
It's like BGP having a router ID and an OSPF router ID, so you're unique throughout the system. That's about it.
So in terms of hardware packaging then, are you planning on releasing a range of hardware? So for instance, you know, you could drop out for home-based users a small box, which can sit on a DSL tail, and you know, for a campus kind of site, a slightly bigger box, or you know, that kind of thing. Are you eventually going to go down that route? And where does your hardware sit at the moment in terms of kind of performance?
So we have two flavors. One is a gig encryption, which is Cavium-based. The other is a 10 gig encryption. And we're coming up with a lower end 100 meg box, which is the small office, home office. And one of the interesting things we do in those type of environments, because there is an expectation that since we made the bring up so easy, what if somebody steals the equipment? There is a GPS inside of it. So when you send out a box, the controller says, this box is only allowed to come into the network. The controller would take it over if it's on these GPS coordinates. So if you move that box, then it will raise a flag saying second factor authentication required. Was this a permissible move?
That's very cool.
If it's not a permissible move, then the controller will take that under control. You will have choices that you can let him come into the network. If you think there is somebody who's trying to do the weird things, you can route that traffic without them knowing through a scrubbing site and saying, I'm monitoring this guy's actions. Or you can say the controller will take it over and says, I will take control of you, but I will not tell you about any other data plane points in the network. So I have you under control. You are at the wrong GPS coordinate. Unless somebody comes and says it's a permissible move, I'm not going to let you into the network.
So you effectively, when you discover something weird, you can sort of isolate that guy and put him into a honeypot or monitor what he's doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, and you can do service insertion, so you can do anything you wish with him.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
By the way, how well does GPS work in like a basement data center in New York?
See, this is an interesting point, because GPSs don't work well in the basement data centers, but basement data centers is not where the larger thefts will happen. The larger theft points will happen at your home or at your branch offices. So yes, people would like to have a GPS, but if your data center is not properly locked inside of these data centers, you have a bigger problem to worry about than GPS.
Nice answer.
GPS is a problem in the branches or small office home offices.
Coming back to the documentation and product description, where can people find more information about your product?
For earlier learning about us, you can go to viptela.com, and then you can sign up, and depending on how things move, we open up access to our customers and our partners to learn about our technology. But at the higher level, you can learn a lot about our technology by going to our website, but you want bits and bytes, implementation details, then you need access to our documentation, which is on need to the customer basis or partnership basis.
So you're still in semi-stealth mode?
From documentation perspective, yes.
So I need to be a reasonably interested customer and then sign NDA or something, and then we can go into details.
Yeah, and then we'll open up all our documentation.
No, I mean, that's fair.
Yeah, that's pretty normal. Quick question then before I shut up and stop asking you questions. IPv6, so can you support it? Do you support it today? Are there plans to support it tomorrow? And is that on the WAN side and the kind of LAN side as well?
IPv6, we'll have support in first quarter 2015. And we're starting with from the transport side that anybody can provide any kind of transport and soon follow on the local LAN side as well. Our architecture is so interestingly clean that for us, an IPv6 transport are just address families. So it's not a significant control plane work. It's a data plane work, which we are doing at this point. So we will support IPv6.
That's good to hear. I mean, IPv6 is not new, is it? After all, it's just it needs some hugs. So thank you for that. That's good to know.
Yeah, but there are some places in the world where IPv6 will start working better than IPv4 because of excessive net.
and so that's why we want to get IPv6 into both sides as quickly as possible. So it's coming very soon.
Oh, another question just occurred to me now that you mentioned the address families. Would that sort of imply that you're using BGP internally?
It's a very BGP-inspired protocol. So if you go to our website, you will see an individual who is the original author of BGP.
Yeah, I've seen him, yeah.
So you know him, right? Mm-hmm. So we're working very closely with him. We have done some very, very interesting work, which we want to publish next year. So there is a lot of inspiration from a lot of protocols. We're saying you can't abandon 30 years of innovation and said what we've done in 30 years is all gone. There are so many interesting pieces that you will leverage from there. There are interesting pieces from other protocols as well. From control plane, we have leveraged, and we have not touched anything on the data plane side. There's standard IPsec headers, there is standard other overlay encapsulations we're going to be using. So we haven't made changes there, but it's a very BGP-inspired protocol, which we want to publish next year.
So on the data plane, you are using IPsec between the endpoints.
Yeah, that's standard IPsec, yes. Yeah. It's just data plane, yeah.
Which is nice, because then I know how to configure the firewalls. There's no surprise there.
Exactly.
And you said it works over NAT, which means it must be IPsec over UDP.
Yes.
Perfect. Any other prerequisites for the networking gear or anything along those lines if I want to start the pilot? Or do I just plug the box in and off we go?
You plug the box, you configure a local site if you want OSPF, BGP, and off you go.
Sounds cool.
Rest is magic. And one thing that we kept very, very focused as we were building this protocol, that we've all lived our life without 3 a.m. calls. A lot of people have brilliant engineering ideas, but if you can't operationalize it, it's a nightmare. So we've kept operations guys in mind, and that's why I was mentioning that it's a very BGP-inspired protocol, that it's the 3 a.m. call that you're able to isolate and minimize the impact of the failure. We've looked at everything from high availability to a single controller failure to scale-out controller model, how individual controller fails, how individual link fails, node fails, how services fail, because I've lived those 3 a.m. calls. And if I can't justify a 3 a.m. failure, it might be the greatest technology, but if I cannot isolate, troubleshoot, and solve problem with that 3 a.m. call, I haven't done a good job as a networking company.
Agree.
Absolutely. So I've just thought of one more thing as well. Does your controller provide nice visualizations? So can I take a snapshot visually what my deployment looks like today from your controller?
So we have another function in this, which we call the management layer. We call it vManage, and it has all the graphical interfaces, and you can see you monitor all your network. It maps to your geolocation. So it has the complete data plane functions. You can look at it. It's how my data plane is laid out. You can click and look at how your control plane is laid out. You can look at the site-level granularity, how sites are connected. So all of those functions, you can look at a snapshot from that management GUI interface we provide.
Fantastic.
One last question, Khalid.
Yeah.
What you described sounds like a perfect enterprise software-defined VPN product. So are enterprises your only target market?
No, carriers as well. Actually, we have two international carriers, as I mentioned earlier, very aggressively looking at it. Why I say that? If you look at one of the things that we kept is we've virtualized a lot of path controller sitting and saying, I can take any type of circuit and I'll provide you that ubiquitous connectivity that MPLS was providing based on policy. One connection could be on internet, the other could be on MPLS. If there is an IP path between them, I can provide that ubiquitous data plane. So from the carrier's perspective, they can expand their MPLS service where they don't have a footprint and they can say, I can, based on a local heat map, I can connect these sites, bring them on this overlay to my closest POP where I have an MPLS peering into my MPLS connection, and I pass these routing, and now I have this any-to-any connectivity over public internet going through this MPLS point back into my MPLS network. From that perspective, when I don't have a footprint, I can expand my service. That's the discussion we're having with an international tier one carrier who's trying to enter U.S. market space.
Oh, hold on. So what you're saying is I'm offering MPLS VPN services in region X.
Right.
And I have customers who want to have endpoints in region Y, but I'm not in region Y. So today I have to tell them, sorry, go somewhere else, and they go to my competitor.
Right.
So tomorrow I'll just deploy these data plane endpoints at some strategic exchange points or wherever I want to deploy them. And then whenever a customer wants to have connectivity, I just send him that box. He plugs that box in, and that box finds the nearest data plane conversion point, if you wish, yeah. And the traffic goes over there, and then it enters my MPLS VPN network, and I deliver it to the customer.
Right. And one of the interesting things that you can do in that model is you can make sure to monitor a little bit more strictly. You make sure all those devices go through those service chain point, IPS, IDS, firewall, then go into the MPLS network. And your MPLS network is all of a sudden extended to a point where you don't have a footprint.
And because your protocol is not so far away from BGP, I guess that you can peer with the service provider's MPLS VPN BGP backbone, so I don't have to run something like inter-AS option A with VLANs for every customer.
Until we get pervasively deployed in the carrier, you will have to, but ultimately that's the goal.
Perfect.
Hmm. That's really interesting. Hmm. Got me thinking now.
Yeah, I think we'll get some crazy ideas off this podcast. So, if you guys enjoyed this show, and I hope that by now everyone is interested in SDN-based VPNs, you know where to go. It's viptela.com. Now, Khalid, if people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that? Do you have a blog, Twitter handle?
So we have a Twitter handle. I don't yet, but they can contact me at khalid@viptela.com, or they can send an email to sales@viptela.com.
Perfect. David. What about you? Where can people find you?
So you can find me at my blog, which is ipengineer.net, or on the Twitters, you can find me at lsp42.
Oh, one more question, Khalid. If people want to meet you in person, where will you be in November, December, January timeframe? Attending any conferences or sitting in California?
I'm planning to go to IETF in November, but those plans are not finalized. I have an OSPF draft that I have to go and defend, so I haven't finalized that I'll be going, but I have plans of going to the IETF in November.
So people, if you want to meet Khalid in person, go to IETF meeting, which isn't a bad idea anyway. And finally, I'm Ivan Pipelnyak, and you can find me blogging at ipspace.net. And if you really want to follow me on Twitter, my Twitter handle is at iOSHints. To learn more about SDN, go to ipspace.net/SDN, where you'll find links to all things SDN related, including podcasts, webinars, workshops, and so on and so on. And if you get lost in all the content on my website, you just might decide that what you really need is a webinar subscription, which gives you access to all of that. Finally, if you like the show, please do your homework. Tell a friend, leave a review on iTunes, and don't forget to follow us at podcast.ipspace.net.